There was a couple of moments where it did veer slightly towards the happening.
Very much so, and I
thought, oh God, careful, knowing. Yeah, and yes, knowing as well. Knowing the Nicolas Cage one, which is terrible, and happening, the happening, which is also terrible. Luckily, it didn't fall down that road, but there was a couple of, just, it might have been just a shot once or twice, I thought, oh no.
If you take Ethan Hawke and you replace him with Nicolas Cage, this film's just a completely different animal.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see it. So, George, how was Julia Roberts?
Oh, you know what?
As good as you think.
She's an icon.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this because I went to the screening. It was basically, they called it a special screening. It was really a premiere.
Yeah.
Like a mini premiere.
I was surprised when I saw the video on at Pop Kitchen Podcast Instagram when I was like, oh, yeah, it was a carpet. You had a picture done.
I did.
With a friend of the show.
With friend of the show, Lucy Heath. Came with us. You can check out her episode last year about the Tribeca Film Festival. And I had no idea that there was going to be talent there. And sure enough, the PR people were like, yeah, people are coming. Yeah. It's like, great.
People. I could totally undersold it.
And it was in the Curzon Mayfair, which, nice. If anyone saw the photo I posted, which is very much like a low-key TVA 1970s interior with sort of deep circular square reveals in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was part of the TVA.
Yeah.
And sure enough, yeah, Julia Roberts comes in. And Julia Roberts is one of those movie stars, like, she's up there. And, you know, she's in her fourth decade of being in movies now. And she's absolutely iconic. And not just that. So it's not just that when you see her, you go, oh, Julia Roberts. Mm. She was so charming and so nice and absolutely just
only heard good things about Julia Roberts.
She was walking in and she was walking down the aisle, which was very long. She sort of stopped halfway, looked at everyone and said, this is so awkward, right? This is so weird.
Yeah.
And walked down to the front. Edith Bowman teased her about the fact that Man United were winning 3-0. And she was like, yeah, go Reds. Very American. And she was just so charming and so brilliant on stage. She's produced the film. And so she was really keen to, you know, get her selling points across. And she almost like wrapped up the Q&A very quickly because she basically said to Edith Bowman, I think we should let everyone watch the movie. And Edith Bowman was like, no, I actually have another question for you. And then what was nice is that when she came back up the aisle, she saw, I believe their name is Riley Parker, who wrote Everything Now.
Okay.
Which is on that TV series on Netflix, Tandoi Newton's child. Anyway, Julia Roberts saw them and was like, and like went over, gave it like leaned over people. She was like, excuse me, I'm sorry. Like gave him a hug. Yeah. How are you doing? Like, hey.
Yeah.
Waved people. Just like, she was in no rush to leave. She was having a great time. And I was like, you look like a class act.
Because the whole promo, press, premiere, interview thing, when you're of the age and caliber of Julia Roberts, you've done it all. You've come up.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So all of this like promotion, talk show, interview nonsense must just feel like so boring and monotonous. You're like, okay, sure, whatever. I'm fine. Mm. Whatever I need to do that's in my contract, which I probably whittled down anyway, let's get it done.
But I guess that's the test of a real pro.
Totally.
Because she's been through the mill so many times. She knows the drill.
I had the same reaction at the BAFTAs when I saw Kate Winslet. Mm. There were lots of famous people there. Like I was literally an arm away from like Ben Whishaw, Gary Oldman. Mm. And then you had lots of TV people who like are obviously famous in the UK, but like they're not.
Ramesh Ranganathan.
Yeah, like Ramesh and like Lee Mack. And like, all the great main Chelsea people. And I'm like, cool. But then Kate Winslet came onto the carpet and you just, again, like not only did she get the attention, but just radiating star quality, elegant, classy.
You're like, what's that? I smell Oscar. That's what it is. I smell an Oscar.
Just kind and it always just says the right thing and behaves in just the right way. It's more than acting. It's a way of life.
Julia Roberts has that $1 million smile as well.
Oh, yeah.
It was just that great.
That cutesy Notting Hill pretty woman.
Just a girl.
Well, she's not smiling in that one. But
she's smiling when she says that, I think. She does smile, crying.
She's a little goofy grin.
I'm just a girl.
Yeah.
Trying to hold it in.
Asking
a boy.
I want to rewatch Notting Hill. It's so good. Well, if it were to be that way for me, I would
My favourite is the... You're a little bit Boris there.
Well, if you wanted to go to my bookshop...
If it was to be... Well, yes, four.
Travel bookshop there with the blue door.
You've got to turn up the toff meter for Boris.
For Hugh Grant, what I love in Notting Hill is that bit where he spilled the orange juice on her, or the coffee, whatever it is.
Yeah.
They go up to his flat, and he's opening the fridge door, and he's like, ah, we have, some... apricots in honey. I don't know why they're in honey. If you want to buy honey, you could just buy honey. And she's just like, yeah. just like again, it's not so the tough dumb meter, but just like Richard Kerr just going, bah, posh, 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 posh.
Yeah. Only posh people just have apricots soaked in honey. It was just on a whim.
I can afford to live in Notting Hill.
Yeah.
On a travel bookshop. Not just any bookshop, a travel bookshop.
Like, you live in Beverly Hills and I live in Notting Hill. As if Notting Hill is at like prime London real estate. That house that he lived in, I haven't seen it in a long time. That's a £6 million house.
Yeah, totally.
Easily.
That film also got a lot of flack for basically misrepresenting the area of Notting Hill as well. Because Notting Hill is actually historically a very diverse neighbourhood.
Yeah.
And then this was just sort of like, no, it's about Hugh Grant and his little travel book shop.
Floppy little hair.
Yeah, fantastic.
Great movie though, gotta see it.
Indeed. Whereas I think that holds up better than Four Weddings, which I've not seen for many years.
I've only seen that once a long time ago.
I think that's a bit naff. That has the terrible line, is it raining? I hadn't noticed.
Yeah.
Welcome to episode 105 of Pulp Kitchen. Hello, listeners new and old. Not old listeners, but regular.
Might have given it away, but we're going to be reviewing Leave the World Behind.
That's right. New Netflix movie with Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, Ethan Hawke, and newcomer Maya La.
I'm also going to be talking about a new film starring George Mackay called Femme, and the guy who was in Misfits,
Nathan Stewart Jarrett,
who, spoiler alert, is brilliant in this.
But I will be talking about...
No, not actually a spoiler.
For a second, I was like, why would you do that?
It's a spoiler for my own review, if people are on the edge.
No, not James' review. I've been waiting. That's what we're going to be talking about this week. We'll, of course, do your emails as ever, and we will finish with a game. I've got two rounds of games for you this week, James.
Nice.
We look forward to doing that. So, that was my week. Let's do it. James. You went to see Femme.
Yes, Femme, directed by first-time duo Sam H. Freeman and Ung Chun Ping, set in a modern-day London. It was actually based off of a short that was starring Harris Dickinson. Mm. And for me, Harris Dickinson and George Mackay are in that kind of same category of like skinny, blondish, British, young.
Slightly gritty,
sort of hard roles. Anyway, it's actually a short that got picked up and made into this feature film. Set in modern day London, Nathan Stewart Jarrett, who you'll know from Misfits, and I think the Candyman, I think he was in that as well.
Okay.
Plays Jules, who is a drag artist who performs in a nightclub called Fallacy. And after performing his set, he makes eye contact with a sort of very... street dress, very uber masculine George Mackay, who as he's going to buy cigarettes after a set, ends up in an altercation with George Mackay, who plays Preston, and a load of his friends, ends up being violently attacked on the street. God. Horrible blow to the head. They take the clothes off and they just in a terrible situation. You then cut to 3 months later and Jules is very much depressed and withdrawn, really shaken by the attack. And through some circumstances, which will reveal itself to you if you go and see the film, ends up dating Preston, his attacker. But the thing is that when Jules was attacked, he was in drag. So Preston does not recognize the fact. So Preston is closeted gay, right? Mm. And Preston does not recognize the fact that the person he's now dating was the person that he attacked 3 months ago. Mm. And so what you have is this very intense revenge thriller that's very sexy and intense and often violent, and I thought it was really good. I really did enjoy it. It's a really interesting commentary on masculinity. One of the opening shots of the film is Jules putting on his costume and putting on this whole material of drag. There's this real emphasis on clothing and how masculinity and femininity is an identity that we wear, and it sort of works for both ways. And both of these people that we meet and how they date becomes really well deconstructed. And I was watching it and I was thinking, maybe this is a little bit cliche, and I think in lesser hands this whole concept might feel a bit cheesy, but it's really well done. I think it handles its subject matter with a really firm hand. It takes its time to tell its story. It handles a very simple dynamic in a relationship. Not a simple dynamic, it handles a very singular dynamic in a relationship very well. And it doesn't deviate too far from that. Like it says, let's go for one thing and do that quite well. And it sort of, you know, it made me think a lot about the representation of modern day gay sex in film and how, you know, it's sort of tragically underrepresented and how there are all these really intense dynamics that I don't think mainstream cinema and pop culture has often been privy to. And I hope, I mean, you know, I'm a straight guy, so I can't say, you know, I can talk about lived experience, but I think that tackles that whole subject really well. The ways in which sex and aggression and masculinity is challenged and enhanced in that very heightened environment of people who are wanting to engage in gay sex but are ashamed of who they are and the fact that they're gay, ashamed of the fact that other people might find out, and how that manifests in a very sometimes nasty, intense but very sexual way. And I was like, this is a conversation that's not really had in cinema, and I think this film did it really well. There's times where it felt a little bit baggy, and there's certain scenes with certain characters where you think, yeah, you're like, you're almost catching on to an idea. But all in all, really great performances. George Mackay doing something I think very very interesting with the role I think we've seen before in film, right, of a sort of very aggressive repressed homosexual. And then I think Nathan Stewart Jarrett, brilliant. Just really electric and magnetic the moment you see him on screen. Really, really interestingly done. I do recommend people go and see it. I had a good time with it.
Oh, great. Well, that was Femme.
Femme.
Which, if you've seen it, please let us know your thoughts to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. May I ask you a question related to, but not about that film, which is Misfits itself?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? But I remember that was 2009. When I think about Misfits, I think purely really the first series.
Yeah.
And I remember it being this kind of breakout hit. And I remember it was very like late 2009. And I just remember it spreading like wildfire. And I watched it all within a week. And I got hooked. I remember actually it being at a New Year's party.
It was similar caliber to Skins for me, of like clearly aimed at young people, very sort of like young adult, but very grown up subject matter.
Yeah.
Very sexual.
For people who don't know, Misfits was a story about five or six
something like that.
What's
kids
the
on like on juvenile
in juvie, but it's not juvie. What's it
a community service kind of thing.
Yeah, basically.
You have to paint walls and
pick glitter, and they're in these kind of like, you know,
jumpsuits,
orange jumpsuits, and they're caught in this storm at the beginning, and the storm is this weird electrical storm which gives them all superpowers. Do you remember in the first series it was all that like they gave them all but one person the superpower, and they, you know, and it's like quite sexualized, very stylish, and you have people who's like, you know, the sort of pent up nerd, the kind of the jock, the kind of the cheeky one, and it was really good and really addictive. I remember it being
it got
like
quite
that
out there, like towards the end, time travel, the guy who plays
it got really silly as well. It really really fell apart. But that first series of Misfits, that's like a bit of nostalgia for me. I think,
I've really forgotten show as well.
I associate that. 2009, I could hear the music, I was listening to.
And what's your name from Game of Thrones who talks a bit like this?
What's his name?
Ewan.
It's Ewan, isn't it? Ewan.
What's the character's name in Game of Thrones?
Ramsay Bolton.
Ramsay Bolton.
Ewan. Is it Ewan?
It is played by Ewan Rian. Iwan Rian. Iwan. Rayon.
I think that's
which sounds like he could be straight in with the Targaryen family with that name. Rayon. Iwan Rayon Targaryen.
Goodness, yes. Anyway.
Ewan Rayon could be Iwan.
Misfits, great. If you've seen Femme, though, let us know your thoughts, as I said, at hello. Goodness, I can't speak, James. Send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
I want to say, I mean, it's not really a breakout, but like could be a breakout role for Nathan Stewart Jarrett. I think, right, really, really good. I was like, oh, where is this guy? I think he's 38, but I was like, where have you been? You've been you're absolutely brilliant in this. I'm playing that sense of I wear drag to perform, to feel like gender is a performative thing in this side of my life. And then he's put in situations where he has to wear this like masculine side of himself to survive and perform on a totally other side of life. And just a really interesting way to unpack that. And you're left with two people who essentially just skin and bone with nothing but their hearts in the middle of it. I thought that's a really cool play on that. Sorry, just another comment. Very well done.
So talking about Julia Roberts earlier, let's do Leave the World Behind, which is being released in cinemas, but is getting a wider release on Netflix. this week. Leave the World Behind is based on a book and directed by Sam Esmail, which I've been saying all my life as Sam Esmail, misreading a Sam email, but it's Sam Esmail, who was the writer-director behind Mr. Robot.
Yeah.
A series, the first series of which I really loved. I was really, really into it. I couldn't stop boring people about it in 2015. And then season two came along and it was just like, oh dear. Mm. And that was a show, and you kind of see the DNA in this a little bit, full of ideas, stylish execution, peculiar pace. And actually, I forgot to mention, Rami Malek was at my screening, just in the audience.
Whoa.
He just turned up right at the end, just went to the, dressed up in togs, you know, in the proper like suit and everything. Yeah. But like, just sort of crept in, and like, no one else looks like Rami Malek as well. So you can't mistake
He's
him.
He's just there, like, not blinking, yeah. With his jaw out.
He was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, that's Rami Malek. Yeah,
nice.
So which brings us to Leave the World Behind. Sam Esmail was saying he was there at the premiere, that he read this book, sent it to Julia Roberts, who he worked with on his other show, Homecoming, which was on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And Julia Roberts really liked it, produced it. And now we have this film, which I said stars Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, Ethan Hawke, Maya Lahr, and a side order of Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
one rasher, I'd say, of Kevin Bacon.
Week's work? Less?
Oh, maybe 5 days, yeah.
I like it when we try and guess how many days someone did on the thing. 5 days.
But it really is a side order. Don't go in expecting an actual bacon butty. Anyway, here's the premise. It is essentially a small-scale, concept-led disaster movie that focuses on Julia Roberts and her husband, played by Ethan Hawke, Clay, and their two children, a teenage boy, and a sort of around about, I don't know, 10-year-old daughter. Maybe younger, 9.
Maybe older.
Maybe 11.
Yeah.
And basically the film begins with, I have to say, one of the most egregious exposition dumps I think I've ever heard, where Julia Roberts basically says, I've booked us a place in the countryside because you're very stressed at work because of the layoffs, and I need some time off because I'm writing this.
Driving
and
the
children,
the
and
words.
We haven't had a holiday with the children in a while, so I think we should go do this. I was like, wow, just dump the exposition.
No need for a scene. Let's just.
But sure enough, they leave New York. They leave New York and they drive to the outer. Well, I don't know what part.
I think it was like upstate
Long
Island. New York.
Yeah, upstate New York. Yeah. Thank you. And to this wonderful Airbnb, this very nice, almost like the House in Parasite looking thing.
Really modern slick,
concrete,
beautifully
pool
designed,
in this sort of woodland area. And she is really determined to make this a holiday that she, you know, that she likes. She doesn't like people, as she says. She wants to get away from the city. And but there are some peculiar things happening on their journey. The Wi-Fi keeps cutting out. They have some strange... There's a very strange thing that happens when they go to the beach.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not just a little strange thing.
Well, yeah, but really, in the context of all these sort of weird, strange things happening, I have to say that initial bit has very much has overtones of Jordan Peele's Us.
Totally.
Going to the beach house, seeing something strange, this sense of impending doom, impending disaster.
And then you get M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin.
Well, yeah, actually, that's not... But yeah, I was going to get to that. And then the film really kicks into gear when it's nighttime on their first night there. And sure enough, they get a knock at the door. They open it and it's Mahershala Ali and his daughter. And Mahershala Ali's there in a, you know, immaculate tux and says, I'm very sorry. I can't, you know, we, for various reasons, blah, 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 blah. Could we come in?
Dripping with charm, politeness.
Dripping with charm, politeness, sensitivity, and slickness. And you have this question of can I come in? And then the film kind of takes it from there. And we won't waste time trying to plot it through because the film is a mystery concept-based thriller. You mentioned Knock at the Cabin there. I think that's an interesting comparison. James, do you want to give us essentially what you thought of it?
Yeah, I'd say, look, I mean, like, introducing that is it's only like such a small part of what the film eventually goes on.
Yeah.
And I think coming out of it, I was given a lot of really interesting ideas to chew on, especially about the relation of wealth and dealing with issues that come from the exterior, right? You've got this family presented in this uber modern luxurious house experiencing something going on from the outside, but it's very crucially their communications are completely gone. Their Wi-Fi is gone. They can't connect to the other world. With the internet down, it becomes impossible for anyone to find out what exactly is going on and therefore what they should think about it. So the only thing that's left are their own fears, their own prejudices, everything that's literally in front of them, which from a modern perspective is quite unique, right? And so, you know, you sort of like leave the world behind. And I think the film ultimately is trying to answer this whole idea of like, can you ever really leave the world behind? Is the idea of holiday and withdrawing from society an illusion, right? And does it ever really protect you from what's going on? And you've got these two families who are in the middle of apocalypse, but they're also drinking the finest wine and enjoying lovely foods and getting to talk about art and philosophy in their lives when there's like this unspoken horror of what's happening outside. There's also very somewhat interesting Hitchcockian style deer warning them, like nature sort of warning from within. I think that's probably a little bit overused if you ask me. But I think it's about 2.5 hours long, this film. And I did start to feel it, I'd say, in the last 45 minutes. I remember I only realised it was a long film in that last 45 minutes because otherwise I was very engaged. And I was thinking, God, this is really dragging on. Where are we going here? And I think the reason why I felt like that is the film does spend a lot of time introducing semi-horror and teasing a revelation that I don't think really comes in a satisfying enough way given the time I spent with it. Mm. So despite being given lots to chew on, lots of really fun, deeper meanings, which I think make for interesting analysis of the film afterwards, the film only partially satiated me in the end with the materials that I'd been given. And that's kind of where I came out of it. I think you've got really great performances, lots of really, really interesting ideas. I thought the camera work was really interesting, swooping up and down, lots of uneasy Dutch.
Yeah. Quick pans,
parallax effects, which should keep you really engaged.
Could you explain that for our viewers? What's that?
Parallax effect, if you've ever seen a Michael Bay film, when a camera moves from on a long lens and you've got the subject in the middle, and because it moves, the background seems to be moving against the person.
Right.
And it creates this sort of...
Is that like the Bad Boys 2 spin?
Exactly. The Bad Boys 2 spin. That's the Bad Boys 2 spin. Shia LaBeouf on the top of a mountain with Optimus Prime. Parallax. That's like the extreme Michael Bay version, but you've got a lot of those. So the camera moves sort of perfectly within the house. You get that effect. Sorry. It's a little bit baggy, a little bit lengthy, but interesting, tense. A couple of times, you know, the editor between, you know, you've got three different teams of people in different parts, and the music builds and the tension builds, and I feel like it cutted too many times between without giving me something.
Yes.
So I was left a little bit like, I'm still a little bit hungry after this very big meal. That's where I left with it.
I kind of agree with you. I think that on the whole, I was thinking this was pretty solid, and it's interesting. I came out thinking that was solid, but too long. And the thing is that the pacing of the film, I was actually happy with for the most part, because when you have a concept film like this, the worst thing you can do is rush it and barrel through and kind of it's a tightrope walk. You're trying to basically get an audience to engage with material that is basically ridiculous, but in a really sort of grounded way. Yeah. And I think for the most part that kind of works. And it has this kind of very deliberate, stately pace, which I kind of liked and respected.
Yeah, me too.
But the problem is that the longer when the film gets into its third act, when it gets past 2 hours, that starts to work against the film, because I'm thinking you've had this deliberate pace, which has made me feel, as you say, like big revelations are coming. And the point at which the film ends, I wouldn't say it's unsatisfactory. That's the point is kind of like intellectually interesting.
Yes, that's what it
but
is.
But I'm kind of like, I wish that we'd arrived at that 20 minutes ago so I could have enjoyed that a little bit more, because you have really over-egged this pudding, Sam. I think that there is the most interesting section, I think, is in the kind of middle bit, where there's this sort of very, very sub-satirical thing happening about what really irritates middle-class people.
Yeah.
What provokes reactions. You have this scene at the beach at the beginning, which is very minor spoilers, but basically it's probably in the trailer. A giant oil tanker breaches onto the beach there. They're all playing on this, you know, pedestrian tourist beach, and this oil tanker bridges on the sand, and it's this huge spectacle, but they're all kind of bizarrely unmoved by it. And they on the drive home, they pop into a Starbucks and they kind of forget about it straight away. But then as soon as a black couple ring the doorbell in the middle of the night, that's what gets Julia Roberts hat up. And meanwhile, you have, like, on the flip side, Ethan Hawke as Craig being this overly wet kind of spineless is the wrong word, but kind of demasculinized kind of, oh yeah, well, sure, you can come in and you can sit down.
When Julia Roberts
desperate to show his liberal credentials.
Yeah.
Whereas Julia Roberts is kind of get heads up. And that kind of dynamic is really interesting. And Mahershala Ali and his daughter are aware of that. The idea as well, that the idea of it's a wealthy black couple as well, and these guys are just middle class. It's just very interesting. They talk about where they both live in the city. It's very interesting. I agree. Some of the images are great. The cross cutting and the climax scenes is kind of thrilling, but like also very obviously contrived. And the more it happens, the more you're aware of a director sitting in the cutting room going, and then
and then the next one, it's really Lord of the Rings Two Towers going from the Ents to Aragorn to Frodo, like heavy.
Oh, really,
we've
really
got
really.
Three people in three different places. We're just going to cut between.
There's this sort of there's a kind of one too many times of a metaphor revolving with some deer about the flipping of nature. There's some stuff which I just think. Over egging the pudding didn't need to be in there, less is more. Like, there's some stuff with some flamingos. I just thought, no, they need to be in there.
The deer I thought were overused. Yeah. And I mentioned Us before.
Yeah.
The Us presents a really huge mystery that unfolds throughout that whole film.
Yeah.
But the ending of Us, even if you think it's really out there and very ridiculous, which if you said that, I'd be like, you're totally fair.
Yeah.
It's a very satisfying answer to the puzzle that Us presents to you.
Yeah.
And the ending of it leaves you with a lot to chew on. And I go, even if that is mental... That's kind of cool, though.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool, and it earned it, and the evidence was there. So I think, you know, intellectually, it's very stimulating. And there's you know, talk about the length. There's like some really long dialogue scenes, especially between Julia Roberts and Mahershala Ali. They have, I think, have a 15-minute scene within that film. And I'm glad that scene exists because it's really interesting, and it puts those two characters against each other and brings them together. But within that, where are we going?
Yeah.
What are we trying to say?
I like it's a film that I like it when a film does this as well. When it go, I remember this happening. The first time I remember thinking this is when I saw Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is a film that said, instead of shooting a flashback sequence, why don't we just get a very good actor to sit down and tell the story of what happened? Because it's immediately actually engaging, kind of by doing it less, it's somehow more.
Like in Jaws.
Exactly. So that's what happens with Mahershala Ali's character. He has a couple of times where he sits down and tells a story and you think,
It's great. It's really good.
When you said about Knock at the Cabin, this is exactly the kind of film Knock at the Cabin should have been.
And could have been.
Yeah,
really
have been.
Easily could have been. If you don't know, we really just didn't see the point of Knock at the Cabin. And it was frustrating.
Like, despite our slight reservations about Leave the World Behind, Leave the World Behind delivers the kind of intellectual and kind of concept thrills that something like Knock at the Cabin begged for, but actually like quickly abandoned. I mean, there's actually like one... like imagery in terms of things that happen in both films. I was like, wow, that's kind of very, very similar there. But this is so much more interesting and intelligent. I think that... what do I think,
James? There's something, a slight element about what all the individual members of the family represented. You can point at me like, well, that person is consumerism and is privilege and prejudice.
Yeah.
And I'm just making that up, but a little bit like, okay,
I do think like the experience of watching it is probably greater than the experience afterwards. Like
I think so too. Very engaged.
Invested, and then, but afterwards I was kind of thinking, well, that kind of didn't really go anywhere and stuff. There is one really funny bit with Ethan Hawke that made me laugh. Not him specifically, but just like, you've had so many weird things happening, right? They've been dripped throughout the film.
Yeah.
And there's something that happens in the third act with his son. And he sort of comes to the room and Julia Roberts is like, look, look. And he goes, what? Oh, what the fuck? Everyone in the audience laughed.
And I will say the side of Kevin Bacon is a good side.
It's a good side of Kevin
Bacon.
Very,
he's great in it. Yeah, really, really good. It's actually one of my favourite scenes, like that moment when they sort of talk to each other.
Yeah.
Very good. Very, very good.
But I think, I actually do think though, in a way, despite our slight reservations about it, this is, I think, is exactly the kind of film Netflix should make.
Yeah.
Is that it is kind of mid-budget, with big name actors in it, concept led, and with
good hook,
with a good hook, it feels slightly experimental. These kind of films actually
keeps you engaged when you're watching it.
These kind of mid budget concept led films are fewer than they used to be, especially in like being released in cinemas. And I do think, in a way, there was something I was thinking when I was watching it. I was like, this film feels actually very suitable to be watched both on the big screen and at home.
I agree, yeah.
And I just think...
there's something to be gained from both, I think.
Streaming platforms, and in this case Netflix, I think would do well to lean into that kind of...
Sirens on our end.
Do you want to say it one more time?
Just the gate got louder.
would do well to lean into that kind of concept-led idea. So I thought, it's solid.
Mm.
If a little bit... It's solid.
It is
a bit long. Probably could have been tighter, but not. What's my word? It's not worthy of your time.
Yeah. Do you think if you did watch that at home, a la Netflix style, you'd spend the whole time watching it, enjoying it, and then it would end, and you go, All right, time for bed. You would be like, whoa. Yeah, whereas I think a film like Us, comparison, like begs for discussion. Did you notice that thing?
Do you know what it is? Is that a film like Us can deliver those stories, but because it goes you also jump the shark and go, yeah, you do something silly.
Yeah.
This film just stayed on the right side of silly.
Yeah.
Because I never thought there was any moment where the film kind of pulled its trousers down and you went, okay, you've kind of lost
which
me here.
Which it could have done. I wouldn't be surprised if this film had a move.
But the consequence of that is that it doesn't really actually pull any surprises on you, really, ultimately.
And the last shot, you're kind of like, well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I get that.
But as always, guys, we'd love to hear your thoughts. If you had any, don't be afraid to send them in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Leave an email behind to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Good to see Julia Roberts in something different.
Yeah, just completely separately. Love to see Julia Roberts in a real dialogue heavy, talky, lots of stuff to do. She's just great. Cannot be said enough. This episode goes out to you, Julia.
This is actually Before Midnight. If it's Before Midnight meets Knock at the Cabin.
Yes. Yes.
That's your poster right there.
Yeah, with a bit of Peel and Hitchcock.
Yeah, with a little bit of Us peppered in there. Yeah. And a little bit of Hitchcock. And there was one
a film salad.
No, that's not a film salad. There was a couple of moments where it did veer slightly towards The Happening.
I
thought, oh God, careful, knowing. Careful. Yeah, knowing the Nicolas Cage one, which is terrible, and The Happening, which is also terrible. Luckily, it didn't fall down that road, but there was a couple of it might have been just a shot once or twice. I thought, oh no.
If you take Ethan Hawke and you replace him with Nicolas Cage, this film's just a completely different animal.
Yeah.
I kind of want to see it. Anyway. The flip-flops, like driving the car.
Anyway, that is Leave the World Behind. Let us know your thoughts again at hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
This Sunday, I'm going to go watch Martyrs, which is a horror film that has been described as it makes Saw look like Sesame Street.
Oh God!
It's my friend Amy who does the effed up horror nights. Yes. So that's the next film, and she's gone hard.
Martyrs.
I watched the trailer for it. No. It's from 2008, but don't quote me on that. It looks really disturbing, and it's been described as brilliant but agonizing to watch.
Great.
So, yeah, that'll be a Sunday night next week.
Okay.
That's all. Anyway.
Let's get on to some emails,
shall we? Do some emails. Guys, as always, if you want to send an email into the show, you can do by emailing into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. Just
like
Harry did. Harry writes into the show. Do you want me to start? You happy with me to start?
I can do whatever you want.
Hi, George and James. Brackets. I believe George's left to right theory is correct.
Thank you.
The fact that you talk from the left to the right and therefore your name goes first. The sentiment's turning against me. Rally. The James and George fans.
Hear ye, Georges.
Harry goes on to say, I believe my first email got lost in the ether, but nevertheless, longtime lover of the pod. I'm a film studies graduate from Winchester, and I've finally gone through the backlog, and I'm all caught up. George, you're making a face. I thought I'd use another email to draw your attention to a fantastic film.
Stop. Just to stop you there.
Yeah.
Harry. I remember George seeing this email.
Glasses on.
I just remember this email coming in. I remember you said, I read the first line where it said, I believe my first email got lost in the ether. But Harry, if I'm correct, your last email.
Harry, you've got to be careful when you come in hot because George has got
about going to see Guardians of the Galaxy 3 when you had just recently had a breakup. I remember talking about that. I remember reading that out. Harry, we definitely read that email out. So that was, if you send that in October, that would have been in any episode between now and October. It could have been in a bonus, but I doubt it. I think we did read that out. Sorry, Harry, continue.
I thought I'd use another email to draw your attention to a fantastic film that came out in 2013 that follows a young man following his lifelong ambition, pursuing his dream job, a job he believes he was made for. He goes through trials and tribulations to get to the finish line with people around him constantly telling him he's not good enough. However, he gets to the point in his life where he realizes that everything he has worked for was all for nothing. This leads to some incredibly moving scenes dealing with adversity and how life truly has a plan for you, whether you can see it or not.
Is this any film?
I got you gripped? Do I have your attention? This is, of course, is Monsters University, brackets 2013. I wanted to write something quick about the film that is kind of vague yet mysterious. There is a lot more going on for the film, of course, but I wanted to write a funny email, not as good as Monsters, Inc. from 2004, but truly is a great film. Hope to email again soon, Harry.
That's what have been the that has been one of the major discoveries of doing this show. I did not realize that there was such a
split.
No, but not even split, but like passionate support.
Yeah.
For Monsters University, a film I would have otherwise have written off, but I can't believe there's... We've heard you. We do hear that there is support for it.
I am loving the endless sort of 50-episode-long saga of Monsters, English and Monsters University. I'm looking forward to the next one when you and I in passing make a comment about like, oh yeah, that one wasn't as good as that one. Oh, and God. Like people just wake
activate,
up.
Yeah.
Just activate and come for us. Harry also says, P.S. Completely agree with James and his Home Alone 3 take. I believe it is treated harshly, purely because it is called Home Alone 3. Fox clearly wanted to trick audiences by claiming it has something to do with the other two fantastic films. Therefore, people were already sour about the film prior to viewing. It's very much Die Hard for kids. Call it something else and it would be looked upon much more favorably. Harry, thank you. Home Alone 3 is fantastic.
When did you... That must have been last year you made that then, when we're talking about Christmas.
Yeah.
What was your point about it? It's good.
It's good. It's really good and criminally underseen. Okay. And it's my family's favorite Home Alone.
What?
Harry, I screenshotted your PS and sent it to my sisters because they will be like super happy to know that someone else likes it. It is like Die Hard.
Okay. Harry, thank you very much for your email.
Thank you, Harry.
And don't forget, we did read out your other one. Not that I'm bitter. Adam writes this next email and he says, hey, James and George.
Oh, George and James.
I hope you're both well. Third time emailer here. I had to pause your latest episode to give my thoughts on some of the fantastic and iffy movies I've seen recently. Mm. I've been meaning to talk about each individually, but I'll do a whistle stop tour now. Strap in. No pressure to read them all. Well, Adam, guess what? I am. The first is May December, which we reviewed last week. Mm-hmm. I managed to catch this film at LFF on the Saturday morning. I'd never been to the film festival before, and that was the only screening I could get to. But I left the theatre feeling very much the same as George. While it looked and sounded impressive, it didn't actually feel like it concluded very neatly. The packed festival hall left rather quickly and quietly with puzzled faces. We seemed to laugh at a lot of the dialogue and the editing choices. I think that's intentional. It's the kind of soap opera element to it, Adam. But Adam goes on to say, but we were certainly stunned into silence with Portman's monologue at the end of at the start of the third act. Saltburn.
Sorry, just before you move on, I went to a rave on Saturday and I got recognised by one person in the crowd who... What they did manage to say to me in the middle of the crowd was that I love your show. I'm a listener to the show, to which when I shook his hand and said, thank you, that's great. And what he did say was, May December is my favourite film of the year so far.
Oh.
And then we just got back to our party. But thank you, dude, in the crowd who spotted me.
Adam then writes about Saltburn. He says, while it was incredibly well shot and had great comedy, I would pay for you guys to do a whole episode as Richard E. Grant. Maybe for charity. I'm overall mixed. The plot was so predictable and the manipulation scenes were just plain harrowing. Sorry, on the Richard E. Grant, you and I had so many people send me the clip recently where he's putting up his Christmas tree and it's just him clearly have woken up 5 minutes before in his dressing room, like, looking at the snow-filled sky going...
Christmas tree decorations today. Putting them up Saturday.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I just think he looks really happy.
Oh,
I'd love to be as happy as Richard E. Grant. Please go and follow. I love following Richard E. Grant on Instagram. If you don't follow him on Instagram, it's exactly as George's impression is. He's just having the best time reacting to the simple things in life.
It's like, it's like he's gone, oh, I'm putting up the Christmas tree today. I want to tell everyone.
Everyone should know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Adam goes on to say about Saltburn, I felt that Oliver's character just became so incredibly strange and unlikable. He did. Oliver's character did just suddenly sort of decide to change in that kind of...
You kind of root for him in the beginning.
Yeah, you kind of...
Without spoiling stuff.
And then it just kind of pivots and says, no, he's actually going to be Tom Ripley.
Mm. Even the moment in the bath, you're like, yeah, man, go get it.
Whatever you want.
Yeah.
The way I would have improved it is to have the film conclude after the mm-hmm, or to make the posh family more dislikable. Yeah, they're kind of just kooky, aren't they?
Yeah.
As Eat the Rich movies go, the rich were far too charismatic, bar Farley, who's one of the characters. My favourite scene, though, was when Felix shares the family's mourning tradition, mourning is in grieving, with Oliver. The music and genuine heart was lovely, and then a great gag at the end of the scene. Maybe I missed something, because most of my mates were more impressed than I was.
I've had a couple of people say, yeah, I liked it. I liked it to me. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. I think what it is... I think the more films you see, Saltburn is one of those films that if you've seen a lot of films, I think it's not quite as... A guy at work was like, oh yeah, I went to see Saltburn, George. I really quite liked it. What did you think? I said, well, have you seen The Talented Mr. Ripley? He was like, I don't know what that is.
Oh,
I was like, have you heard of Brideshead Revisited? He was like, no. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. I said, but for me, like, it borrowed a lot from that. And he was like, okay. And he said to me that he went and watched that over the weekend. So I'm going to get his review.
Yeah,
I've gone back and seen Mr.
Good. Report back.
Adam also just quickly says, Napoleon, he thought was goofy, epic, historical reality TV. I wanted to love it. I wanted a Gladiator 2, but it did not live up to those expectations. It probably couldn't have, but accents aside, all the actors killed it. The cinematography was gorgeous and the costumes were fantastic. Mm-hmm. I got a little bit sleepy between the arrival in Russia and leaving so-and-so. I'm just going to go over that. But I would happily watch it again. The sheer fun outweighed my gripes.
I play poker with some guy friends of mine, and the day we went to play, I think like two or three of my friends had seen it that day or that weekend, and all of them came in and were like, how was Napoleon? They all went, I mean, what was that about?
Yeah, all of them.
Like, great battle scenes, but I don't know, man. I think they expect, I saw Ridley Scott and Gladiator pedigree, and they really thought they were up for something a bit more challenging, a bit more deep.
And Adam concludes lastly with Anatomy of a Fall. I'll be brief, as you lads have been bang on with your reviews. It grips you from the first scene. Stunning, smart, nuanced. The runtime flew by and I was just smiling the whole way through. Oh. I took a friend along who wouldn't typically choose to see such a film, and she was awestruck. One of those films that I have to temper my excitement out of fear of overhyping it for others. Thank you so much, guys. Apologies for the criminally long email. Keep doing what you do. You're both smashing it. Sirens on my end. Adam. P.S. I went to the episode 100 pub quiz.
Yes,
I do remember you, Adam. Yes. It was such a cool night. We felt privileged to be there. Truly excellent hosts. Bring on the next one. Thank you so much, Adam, for that lovely email.
I like that. I like the little sort of summary of the new recent films. Mm. Yeah, Anatomy of a Fall.
Banging.
So great. It's about when people are like, what's good right now? Because nobody's talking about Anatomy of a Fall who aren't in the scene. I'm always like, Anatomy of a Fall, go and see it. Don't Google it.
Yeah, and it's just really different in a way.
Yeah. This one is from Kanyiso, and I'm so sorry, Kanyiso. I'm so sorry if I've not spelled that right, who says, hey, George and James and George.
Thank you.
So that's like really, so far,
I'm not keeping score, James.
I'm a big fan of the podcast. It was recommended by a colleague at the HW Union. Shout out to Sam, HW Union.
You know what? I think that's in Scotland.
Okay. Shout out
to
Sam.
Like a union, like a students' union.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Shout out to Sam if you're listening. Sam?
If you are listening.
Well done.
We shout to you.
You are you plus one now to the show. You can stay. I was initially hesitant to start because I remember feeling excluded from movie discussions with film bro director friends in school. However, since listening to your podcast and I've been watching more films, felt more confident in critiquing them and loving Letterboxd. Great. So thanks, guys, for making a podcast both inclusive and analytical. No, recently, I watched Dream Scenario after a complete blunder with Showtime's. Nevertheless, I really enjoyed it.
Dream Scenario, the Nicolas Cage film, which I reviewed on a bonus episode a couple of weeks ago.
Yep. The premise and the execution were so well done. The tagline is succinct and the film unravels as a well-thought-out allegory for viral fame with good pacing. The veil between dream and reality was malleable, and they used our understanding of dreams, brackets, see Inception for details, to their benefit. Oh, that's interesting. To use like a really popular film of, I haven't seen Dream Scenario, but like Inception like creates a framework for how dreams work in cinema in some way, and you can sort of like jump off that. That's quite cool. I found the role of the young woman at the midpoint predictable and disappointing, despite the clever use of dreams within her sequence. However, this left a bad taste, so when the film came back to the heart of the story, his family, it was a little too late and unsupported by earlier scenes of familial life. Is that a spoiler?
It's not a spoiler. I disagree, though. I think the scene you're talking about with his family is a big part of it, so that's not a spoiler. But the scene in the middle with, I think the actress is called Dylan Jalula, I thought was really funny and really uncomfortable and really well executed.
Overall, I enjoyed the film. Great work by the entire cast, and as said in the previous episode, an accurately pitched and impressive performance by Nicolas Cage, a national treasure. My question, is there a piece of movie technology or sci-fi theory you would love to see again? This could be put into the hands of another director with a fresh story, more Black Mirror than ill-advised reboot sequel. I'd love to see another movie using the Inception device with a new Inception team. I've talked for ages, so thanks for reading this out, and cheers to 100 more episodes of Great Film Chat. Just opened my Spotify Wrapped, the competition was steep, and I'm happy to announce you my number one podcast of 2023.
Get
As
in.
Always, sirens on our end. K, a budding creative. P.S. I have a thoughtful take on Bottoms, the film, but this email would go on forever and perhaps the ship has sailed. When is the statute of limitations on recent movie release talk? You're within for Bottoms. Yeah.
If you've sat down to write the email, you might as well just throw it in.
I'd say like the only time we had to stop was like we had so many emails about Barbenheimer that we were almost like, we've said it, we've covered it. But that was just because we got so many. But no, you're great. And then he provided, okay, provided a, okay, she, he, he. Kay also provided a screenshot of their Spotify Wrapped stuff, seeing that you listened for 5,798 minutes.
Top 1% of fans. I was in the top 0.01% of Talking Heads listeners on Spotify this year.
0.0. You must have them every day. A lot.
I can tell you, I mean...
And the film would have sort of
the film absolutely spiked it. Yeah. Also, my flatmate, he was in the top 0.0001% of Paul Simon listeners.
That is great.
I'm thinking that's like top 100.
Yeah.
That's one below Stalker.
I saw that, you know, so as creators on, like, we distribute our podcast on Spotify, we get our own creator wrapped, and it gives some really info about you guys and how much you listen, blah, blah, blah. And it, can you guess that all of our listeners are into three different genres of music?
Oh.
So there's the top three.
Oh, okay.
So I've remembered them.
Genres.
Yeah, yeah. So like it was like a, here are your podcast analytics. Separately, your listeners like these three music genres.
Are they quite standard genres?
They're like the genres.
Indie?
No.
Pop?
Yes, that's number one.
Rock?
Yes, that was number two.
Not pop?
Pop was number one.
Oh, sorry.
Pop was number two.
What happened? Did I just short circuit in my brain?
Yeah.
Pop, rock. What's the R&B?
No, close.
Rap?
Yes.
Oh.
Pop, rock, rap. And I was like, okay, they like music.
Oh yeah, they're humans.
Yeah, could have been hip hop or R&B for a third, I'd say. But always. And then we saw how many of you have us in in your top 10% of podcasts. How many of you have us in your top 5% of podcasts? Yeah, how many of you in the top 1%? Guys, we love you.
We love it, 1%. And we appreciate the effort. But you know what I'm going to say? Like Matthew McConaughey in The Wolf of Wall Street, those are rookie numbers. You need to bump those up. Next year, onwards and more. And this final email for today is from Charmaine, who says, hey, I'm a new fan of your podcast and I've been enjoying all the videos. Please, could you do a deep dive on The Crown season 6? I'm a huge fan of The Crown and would love to hear your takes and impressions on it. Best regards, new fan, smiley face. Charmaine, our bonus episode that went out last week talked exactly about that. Part one of season 6 of The Crown. Let us know what you thought about it and we'll talk about it.
Going to the Prem tomorrow.
We are. But when this episode comes out, it would have been yesterday.
Yes, we will be wined and dined. Hopefully. Bow ties.
Yeah, we're back. It's nice to wear. I had to wear a tux at the weekend for my girlfriend's thing. And it's really nice. Sounds
crazy. Yeah.
I'm James Bond. I couldn't say I was on an assignment for this thing that I had to go to. Yes. Forgive me.
There you go, guys. That was the emails. Don't forget, if you want to send an email to the show, we'd love to hear it. Send one in to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. George, you were going to say?
I was going to say, James, shall we conclude, like we do every episode, with a game?
Let's do it.
James, I have two rounds for you. Mm-hmm. One is a castless countdown, which we will finish with. But the first one is a new one. Okay?
A new game.
It took me a little bit of while to put it together, so that's only one we've got one round. Okay?
Okay, that's fine.
But James, are you ready to play? I'm going to ask you to name certain things. It's not a name 7 and 30. It's more unique than that. But James.
It's more unique.
James.
Okay.
Can you name the Pixar movie from the character?
Oh, okay.
In 3, 2, 1. Violet Parr.
Incredibles.
Yes. Merida.
Merida? Brave?
Yes. Bing Bong.
Bing Bong is in Inside Out.
Yes. Ken.
From Barbie? No, Ken. Oh, sorry, Toy Story 3. Yes.
Hopper.
Hopper is from A Bug's Life.
Yes. James P. Sullivan.
James P. Sullivan. Sully is from Monsters, Inc.?
Yes. Barley Lightfoot.
Barley Lightfoot? No.
Onward.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Bruce.
Bruce. Finding Nemo.
Yes. Wheezy.
Wheezy. Wheezy is Toy Story 2.
Yes. 22.
22.
22.
22.
Soul.
Ah, oh, okay.
Ernesto de la Cruz.
Ernesto de la Cruz. Is that from what's it called? What's it?
Coco.
Coco.
Arlo.
Arlo.
The Good Dinosaur.
Oh, okay.
Sid that. Phillips.
Sid Phillips, Toy Story?
Yes.
Sid. You had a last name?
Anton Ego.
As it is from Ratatouille.
Finn McMissile.
Finn McMissile? Planes?
No, that's not Pixar 1 technically. Similar, James, come on.
Cars?
Cars
2.
Yes. Eve.
Eve? Eve from Wall-E.
Yes, and Carl Fredrickson.
Oh!
Mr. Fredrickson! Can I come in now?
No, I don't have it.
Up.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah.
There you go. That, that was good. The Pixar characters.
You did well to do like the fifth supporting character in that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Challenged.
Yeah. I thought, like, I didn't know Sid had a last name.
Neither did I, but I thought that's going to throw him.
Yeah.
So, hello, Mr. Sid Phillips.
Sid Phillips.
Finn McMissile, I'm like, it has to be. What was he? Planes.
I know. I thought, like, you know what I mean? Yeah.
It's so like obvious that you think it must be like the knockoff.
I've seen Cars 1 once on Sky, and I was like, this is completely different to what I thought it would be. I thought it would be more of a racing film, and it's like he totally just wanders off.
Yeah.
I must see that. Owen Wilson.
And then Cars 2 is a spy movie. And then Cars 3, they were like, we're going to go back to doing the thing we did in the first one.
I associate Cars films with the thing on those not iPads, the Fisher-Price tablets.
Oh, yeah.
That kids are given by their parents to just occupy themselves.
Ah, yes.
There's something about cars with eyes and faces that just captures the attention of a child.
The lowest age group in the Pixar age bracket.
And that's not to say that Cars isn't good. I just mean there is something, there's lightning in a bottle for them about seeing things move around on wheels with eyes and making color, brightly colored.
Yes. Yes.
They've got something there.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next round, which is a...
That was a review of Cars.
This is a Carsless Countdown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
James, it's a fairly short one. I'm going to name the actors in a cast list, mm-hmm. and you have to tell me what the film is. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
James, guess the movie from the cast. 3, 2, 1. Claire Danes.
Okay. Stardust.
Dermot Mulroney. Rachel McAdams. Luke Wilson. Sarah Jessica Parker.
Whoa.
And lastly,
whoa,
Diane Keaton. Do you have any idea what that film is? Claire Danes, Dermot Mulroney, Rachel McAdams, Luke Wilson, Sarah Jessica Parker, Diane Keaton. It's to do with this time of year.
New Year's Eve, Christmas.
No, incorrect. That is a film called The Family Stone.
Oh, no idea.
But popular with my girlfriend and my flatmate.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It's got a poster that's someone doing that with an engagement ring.
Okay. And I think it's a good thing they live together. Do they watch it?
No, it's just that my girlfriend was like, I love The Family Stone. And then my flatmate was like, me too. And I was like, what is The Family Stone? I thought that was the second half of
a
band.
I've never heard of that film.
Oh,
do you think I've seen the poster? Get the poster up so I can just... I went Claire Danes Stardust.
2005, by the way.
Okay, so getting on.
Stardust, that's a good one.
Yeah. Stardust got a huge cast. Never seen that poster in my life.
Look at those actors. Look at those famous actors.
Yeah.
That's a just post Mean Girls, Rachel McAdams.
Yes. Luke Wilson in his prime, I'd say.
Mm.
Did he
have a prime?
That's what it would be. I think my super ex-girlfriend is his prime.
I thought his prime was technically the Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, that could be that too.
Claire Danes. I saw Claire Danes in London last year. Just she walked past me and I was like, she looks very cool because she lives in London because her husband is British.
There you go.
Hugh Dancy. That concludes the games for this episode. And that also concludes this episode of Pulp Kitchen, which is episode 105. And James, I'm going to let you say that your thing now.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Pulp Kitchen. Don't forget, we post new episodes of this show every single Wednesday.
Yes. And... you guys know what I'm going to say, but please continue to like, subscribe, and follow us on social media, Instagram, TikTok. We really do appreciate it. When you guys comment on stuff and share it and add it to your story, we do notice it. It does help us
grow.
We
see every single one.
The algorithm likes it.
We're not that big.
You know, pay your finger tax, as it were, to the algorithm gods.
Yeah, I loved seeing everyone's Spotify Wrapped because I always kind of forget about it, even though other people post their personal music ones. We then just get this inundation of like 20 plus people sending us all of their, the fact that we were your number one podcast next to like the Joe Rogan Experience and like Off Menu and Diary of a CEO. The fact that you chose us over those fuckers is amazing.
That is pretty cool. Also, how was your rap this year? Mine was a bit skewed.
Yeah,
I had like nosedived into two obscure jazz albums. Not that I'm a big jazz listener, but like in January, just I guess to pass the winter months.
Yeah.
And that completely screwed my whole reading.
Mine was like very Fred Again heavy because I saw him at Glastonbury and I just run to Fred Again quite a lot. I'm so basic, but he was great. And yeah, I was glad to give him my number one spot.
Anyway, thanks very much, guys. We'll see you next week.